Okay, we're going to go on to case number 3, although it seems like it's case 23 by now. 061750 Hammer versus Ashcroft. And it's Mr. Bell. Morning, Mr. Bell.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Chad Bell, and I represent the plaintiff appellant David Paul Hammer. As this Court is aware, this is the second time this case has come before it on appeal. In this case, Mr. Hammer is challenging a prison policy enacted and enforced by the defendants that bans federal death row inmates and only federal death row inmates from meeting face-to-face with the press.
Mr. Bell, I have a factual question for you. You use the term federal death row inmates, mm-hmm. and as I understand it, Mr. Hammer's sentence was vacated, and so he, unless there has been a new sentence of death imposed upon him, is he a federal death row inmate because he's being retried, or is what's his status exactly?
Your Honor, his status is he's still housed on the special confinement unit.
Well, and so are lots of other people, which is part of your argument. But if he's not under a sentence of death and he's under these restrictions, then he seems to be a class of one. If he is under a sentence of death again, then your case is the same case you've been litigating all along. But I'm not sure what his status is right now.
Yeah, Your Honor, his status is up in the air. He's currently awaiting resentencing or rehearing. Until that resentencing or rehearing is held, he is being housed on the special confinement unit as a death row prisoner.
The warden treats him as a death sentence, in a penitentiary does.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
Even though he may, depending on what happens with this rehearing, he may at some point not be.
Yes, Your Honor. And if in this rehearing Mr. Hammer had his death sentence vacated and were imprisoned to life imprisonment, he would not be under the restrictions that he's currently under as a death row inmate.
When is the rehearing? Why has there been no rehearing? When?
Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure why that has not happened yet. It's being held. It's being conducted out of the Second Circuit.
At any rate, it isn't your fault. And it isn't your prisoner's fault.
Exactly, Your Honor. My prisoner's been litigating the case. It's somewhat up in the air as to what's going to happen on that.
Okay. So now, does it really matter whether security concerns were the actual motivating reason behind the media policy if the policy actually does further legitimate security goals?
Your Honor, I think it does in regards to his First Amendment and equal protection arguments. Certainly, the government has to show that there is at least a legitimate penological interest being served. If that interest, as we've presented evidence, and at least on summary judgment, we've presented evidence that these restrictions were adopted to restrict speech because the defendants wish to deny murderers access to the public podium.
Murderers or death penalty?
Your Honor, they said murderers, but the restrictions only applied to death row inmates.
That's right.
And that's a large problem.
As I understand it, any other prisoner, even if he's a murderer who is not under a death penalty, has the right to the access to the media.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't murderers. The classification is you have to be hanged or about to be hanged or shot or whatever the heck the government does.
Whatever they're doing these days.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's the problem here, largely, and that's a large part of our equal protection argument, is that this restriction does not just apply to a certain class of prisoners based on their propensity for violence or the celebrity status of their case. It's based solely on their sentence to death.
There wouldn't be an equal protection problem if the regulations prohibited all murderers, regardless of sentence, from engaging in face-to-face interviews?
Your Honor, I would argue there'd still be an equal protection problem.
How about all prisoners? No prisoner has access.
Your Honor, in that case,
At least your equal protection is shot, even though the First Amendment still flows.
Yes, the First Amendment, and as well, Your Honor, the due process argument, mainly the means by which this policy was enforced and enacted. It was adopted via an institution supplement, an inferior institution-specific rule to a federal regulation, which directly contradicts. The federal regulations set up a scheme by which press interview requests with inmates are to be conducted or decided on a case-by-case basis.
Mr. Bell, I want you to talk a little bit about Turner against Safley, mm-hmm. because it seems to me the consistent message we've been getting from the Supreme Court is that with perhaps, you know, a real outlier concern like explicit racial discrimination, prison restrictions need to be assessed under the Turner framework. And I'm a little uncomfortable with your argument insofar as I understand you to be saying that we don't look at Turner, especially since there are, in fact, First Amendment, you know, the religion clause, but First Amendment claims at issue in Turner itself.
Yes, Your Honor, our argument in regards to Turner, I believe you're discussing our equal protection argument.
Well, and just sort of the court has said when you're trying to assess restrictions on constitutional rights inside the prison, the court has said on the one hand you don't lose all of them, but on the other hand the prisons are tough places and they're legitimate penological interests, and so you have this deferential standard and you need to say that there are some deprivations of liberty, there are some deprivations of First Amendment rights that you do tolerate vis-a-vis prisoners that you would not vis-a-vis somebody who isn't a prisoner. And so it strikes me anyway that that is the lens through which we need to look at this institutional supplement.
Yes, Your Honor. And to the extent the district court looked at that lens, it looked only at the First Amendment claims through that Turner lens. It never addressed Mr. Hammer's equal protection claims under that lens. It never analyzed Mr. Hammer's due process claims under that lens.
So what about the First Amendment claim under that? Is it under Turner, is there some less restrictive alternative compulsion, or under Turner, is it enough for the warden to say, look, this is my best my best judgment about how to keep order within the prison, that's that?
Your Honor, the answer to that comes in Beard versus Banks, which was decided recently by the Supreme Court. And there the court held that while a court is to give deference to a prison administrator and its determination, that deference is to be schooled. And the court even explicitly stated that in Beard, the restrictions involved restrictions on periodicals to inmates who are being housed for behavioral problems temporarily within a unit. As the prisoner's behavior improved, those restrictions were lifted and they were moved into less restrictive units. In Beard, the court specifically noted that if that ban had been a permanent ban, that they might definitely reach a different decision. That permanent ban is what's at issue in this case. Here we have a prisoner who is permanently being deprived of a First Amendment right, not because of an isolated behavioral issue that, you know, that he could eventually address by properly behaving and thus serving the security and penological interests of the facility. This restriction is based solely on the fact that my client was sentenced to death. There's nothing that he can do, short of having his death sentence overturned, to escape this restriction. And I would argue, Your Honor, that the restrictions themselves still have to have a valid, rational connection to the legitimate interest set forth for them.
Why couldn't the federal government take the position, given the fact that you can't get a death sentence without very elaborate set of procedures, as you know, procedures that determine that you're death eligible, procedures that determine that you're not only eligible, but this is an appropriate penalty for you, some surrogate for the worst of the worst. Why can't the government say, well, this has all been determined in the guilt and penalty proceedings, and so we're just going to take that piece of data, you've been given the death penalty, and use it as a way of making distinctions among prisoners?
Your Honor, I don't know that that would have a rational connection to restricting speech. Just because somebody is sentenced to death, and if you accept the argument that people sentenced to death are the worst of the worst, certainly we would contest that argument. Mr. Hammer has a very good behavioral record overall as a prisoner. But if you accept that, there still has to be a rational connection between restricting his speech and, you know, punishing the worst of the worst.
Well, I mean, he has a good behavioral record as a prisoner, but for the fact that he killed another person in the prison.
Yes, so correct.
That's like a fairly large exception.
And you also have, of course, the problem that prisoners on death row have nothing left to lose. I mean, aren't they qualitatively different from other inmates that would be housed in the SCU? I mean, it would just seem, doesn't seem obvious that security risks are going to be heightened with a class of people who are facing a sentence of death? What do they have to lose?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue I'd first note that the reason that the defendants have set forth for this restriction is the jail celebrity problem, as they put it. The idea that an inmate...
Jail celebrity problem, any inmate of a jail can become a celebrity if he does something goofy enough. But I want to know, is there any provision at all for them to have, say, videotaped face-to-face?
No, Your Honor. Not right now. And there is video conferencing facilities available at the United States Penitentiary in Terre Haute.
Would your position be completed if there were such a order entered that permitted the inside face-to-face only through television?
Your Honor, exactly. That would accommodate the right completely, allowing the press to interview Mr. Hammer face-to-face through video conferencing
facilities. And you conceive of what safety issue might be involved in that?
Your Honor, I can't conceive of a safety issue other than what the defendants
have said. Let's find out later whether your opponent can conceive of one.
I can't conceive of a safety issue that would be implicated by allowing that, considering the inmates are already allowed video conferencing for court appearances. And let's not forget, the inmates are also allowed social visits.
Well, I understand that what he wants to do is communicate something to the outside world, which might be a petition to get everybody excited about getting rid of the death penalty, for one thing, which might save his life. I assume that's contemplated.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's definitely part of what his communications seek to do. He seeks to discuss his case with the public. And
what about Pell? The Supreme Court upheld a ban on face-to-face interviews where inmates were allowed to correspond with the media in writing. I mean, why wouldn't that case be dispositive here?
Well, Your Honor, let me answer that question. I notice I'm in my rebuttal time, so let me answer that question, though, before I sit down. First of all, Pell was a state case. The decision applied to all inmates equally, regardless of their sentence within the California system. This restriction does not apply all equally to every inmate. It only applies to death row inmates. And furthermore, Pell was decided, Your Honor, before Turner versus Safely, and before the standard set forth by Turner versus Safely, which we think would indicate a different decision in this case.
And just one quick last question,
yes,
please.
Your Honor.
Why do you think that video conferencing is a reasonable alternative when it's the fact of the televised interview, not the reporter's presence in the SCU, as we noted? That creates the security risk.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that these inmates are, and the amicus briefs point this out, the death row inmates are certainly more restricted than other inmates within the federal system. They have very limited contact amongst themselves. So the jail celebrity problem, as it's somewhat known, is certainly lesser with these inmates.
The idea that another prisoner would think people that kill prisoners, celebrity is kind of a far-fetched idea all by itself.
Well, yeah, Your Honor, and we should point out other inmates. I mean, you know, Martha Stewart, the former governor of this state.
Yeah, she was dangerous all the way around. She talked to her.
So, Your Honor, I'll sit down now and save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
And let that be a lesson to all of you out there. Mr. Himmelfarb, you've come all the way from...
May it please the Court, my name is Edward Himmelfarb of the Department of Justice. I would say Martha Stewart is dangerous in a much, much different way. I would not.
I don't like
she's
her
a low security prison in any event.
Tell me what what specifically is the danger of having, say, a monitored television interview process?
Well, having a videotaped interview, oh, you mean a physical, having the member of the press come into the prison?
No. We're monitoring with the television. That's one way you could do it. Good, isn't it?
Your Honor,
you do that now. The prisoners are allowed that sort of interview now on a television basis.
The non-death row inmates?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. What is the problem with doing that for death row inmates?
Right.
The problem is that the warden of the prison, Warden Lappin, has said in his declaration that it would create more of a risk. It would create a risk of making jail celebrities. This is the same.
Why does he care whether anybody is a jail celebrity, just academically?
Well, because what happens with inmates is not inmates react to each other differently from the way ordinary people outside the prisons react to each other.
How do you know?
Because the warden has said so in his declaration.
Well, there you go. Then we'll have to take that as gospel truth. But what I want to know is, supposing he is a celebrity, why does the warden care? What does the warden say happens?
It affects what the warden said in his declaration was that it affects the way the inmates behave toward each other. He gets more power among the inmates than other inmates have.
Can't the warden take care of that problem by isolation? Isn't he isolated as he is presently?
Well, he is somewhat isolated, not entirely isolated. Your Honor, it is conceivable that some things can be done to mitigate that problem, but that's not the role of the courts, as the Supreme Court
has repeated. No, it's not the role of the courts, but the role of the courts is to make sure the guy's liberty rights and what constitutional rights, what few he has left, are not taken away from him.
That's right, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has basically disposed of this issue in Pell and the Saxby against Washington Post.
No,
which is
I don't
a
think
case.
So.
Neither
I don't think
I.
so. The
so
Supreme Court has
already.
Turner, which does not say, the Supreme Court has never written an opinion that says people leave all constitutional rights at the door of the prison. It has a much more nuanced approach.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. I'm not asking the court to do that in this case.
Yes, you are, I think. You're asking us to say that as soon as Warden Lappin says, I've decided that there aren't going to be any First Amendment rights because it's inconvenient to me, that's the end of the discussion.
Your Honor,
that's not what Turner says.
Your Honor, I apologize. There are First Amendment rights here. There are alternatives to having face-to-face interviews, and those same alternatives were upheld.
But you're not willing to consider the video conference alternative, which is certainly not a face-to-face interview in the same way that you and I are face-to-face right now.
No, the problem, as the warden said in this declaration, the problem is not having somebody physically present there. That is not the problem. The problem is the result of televising the interview. That is the problem. That does not change when it's videotaped or whether it's in person. It's the same problem. All these inmates in...
It's also a problem for the wardens to have to accommodate various religious restricted diets and other kinds of things, certain religious assemblies, but the prisons need to take some steps to accommodate those problems. How many hours a week is this man actually interacting with other inmates?
Well, he has...
Four?
I'm not sure the number of hours, Your Honor, but he has the right to, I believe it's 3 days a week. I could check that.
I thought it was far less than that, actually.
He can go to recreation. Also, inmates are allowed to assist each other with pleadings through
but
these.
But death row inmates? I mean, I'm not sure you're right about this particular subset of inmates.
Your Honor, we asked about this, and what we were told by the Bureau of Prisons, the people who were in charge of this, was that there are two types of contact that these people in phase one, which is where Mr. Hammer is located, have. One is through recreation, although each individual inmate in phase one is sent out alone. My understanding, Your Honor,
Was this put in the record at the time of the hearing that we sent it back down for hearing, and was this put in that the amount of contact?
I don't believe the amount of contact was put in there, but the rationale for the policy was put in there.
I understand the rationale is the warden doesn't like it, so that's about as close as I can get to figure out what the rationale is.
The rationale, Your Honor, is the same rationale that the Supreme Court accepted in Pell and Saxby.
I don't believe that, but go ahead.
Well, Your Honor, if Your Honor would like, I can refer you to the pages of the decisions in which it's the same. It doesn't use the phrase jail celebrity, but it's exactly the same concept that one inmate takes excessive power among the other inmates.
See, the government dismissed the reports of Senator Dorgan's letter and the Ashcroft statements basically as being connected to the policy only by a coincidence of timing. But couldn't a jury infer from that timing that the policy was passed in response to a desire to prevent death row inmates from having a public platform to express the views that the senator and the attorney general found to be so terribly distasteful?
Your Honor, we can assume that, and certainly for summary judgment purposes, we have to assume some factual aspects of those claims, like what former Attorney General Ashcroft said at this press conference. We accept that as true, and we all accept the exchange of letters from Senator Dorgan. But there is nothing inconsistent with the idea that a senator is concerned about what it looks like to the public
on the one hand, and the
warden's rationale on the other hand. Those are perfectly consistent with each other. They're not conflicting. They're supplemental.
Well, but you know, Director Hawke Sawyer announced the new policy at the very same press conference where Ashcroft said that his concern about the glamorization of violence, you know, has shaped our approach to these issues. And why aren't Ashcroft's and Hawksawyer's statements evidence that the policy was implemented for reasons other than security concerns when, so soon thereafter, the warden is, implementing the policy?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, there are two things about that. The first thing is that the warden said in his declaration that they began this policy in the summer of 99 when the SCU was open.
But there you have a discovery problem.
Yes.
One of the issues here
right.
in this case was the inability of Mr. Hammer to obtain proper discovery. Had he obtained proper discovery, he could have tested the extent to which this very policy really was commenced in the summer of 1999 or whenever the warden said, whether it evolved over time or whether it really didn't look anything much like this policy. We're being asked on a blank record to assume that everything you say is true, but there was no ability on the part of Mr. Hammer to probe this.
Well, Your Honor, we can assume the truth of what...
So we have to assume it sprang up 6 days after the, or whatever it was, very, very shortly after the press conference. That's the only evidence we have in this record.
I don't think that's what the record reflects, right? I think the record reflects that there was a press conference 4 days. It was April 12th,
okay,
I believe.
Four days later.
That's right. But if you
and
look
you can't tell me that the warden couldn't have said when he hears from Senator Dorgan and Attorney General Ashcroft, draft a policy, draft it now, have it on my desk at the end of the day.
And then lie and say it was about security.
Well, it's been in the works since 1999. We don't know if that was a fleeting thought inside his head. I don't assume he's lying, but thought inside his head, whether there had been 55 drafts cleared through OMB and everything else. We don't know any of that.
That's right, Your Honor. And we could even assume all that away. We can assume they came up with it at the last minute. But to say that the security rationale is a fraud, which is essentially Mr. Hammer's position.
We don't have to say that it's a fraud. We have to say that could not be decided on summary judgment. I mean, why did the government simply refuse to comply with discovery? If the government was reluctant to turn over sensitive prison information to an inmate, which we certainly, can understand, then actually that would have made his need for a lawyer all the more compelling. Because with a lawyer, you could have had the discovery produced under protective order for counsel's eyes only. The government produced no discovery in response to three timely requests, yet the court holds that fact against Hammer instead of holding it against the defendants?
Well, Your Honor, what happened was that the government raised objections to the discovery requests, and it was not that they refused to comply. It raised what I think are legitimate objections to the scope of the discovery and to the procedures by which the documents were to be obtained.
But the bottom line is no discovery in response to the three timely requests and a denial of a continuance to conduct discovery. So that's problematic, I think.
Well, Your Honor, the reason the discovery motion, I think, was denied, and of course it's a matter of district court's discretion, the reason the discovery extension, the 56J, 56F, was denied is that Mr. Hammer did not explain what he needed the discovery for.
Well, now, remember our recent decision in Pruitt against Moat, which is an en banc decision of this court, in which we discuss comprehensively the standards for appointing a lawyer, both the complexity of the case, the need of the person institutionally. I'm not at all sure that the district court was properly evaluating those issues. You're asking Mr. Hammer to litigate with the sophistication of a member of the Department of Justice.
No, I don't think that's what we're asking, Your Honor. We're asking him. What the district court held was that he was litigating substantially well, considering he was an inmate. He just, you know,
except then he turns around and says, "Oh, but you weren't specific enough. You know, you didn't do this, you didn't do that."
Well,
even though Mr. Hammer does manage to file the 56F motion, which a lot of people fail to throw in there.
Well, I think that also is evidence that he was handling his case quite well, Your Honor.
But it also means that the district court, thinking that there were no disputed issues of fact here, may have misapprehended the case.
Yes, Your Honor. But one other thing to take into account is this: as Your Honor is aware, this is the second time this case was briefed on this very appeal. And the first time Mr. Hammer briefed it alone without counsel.
And that's when this court sent it back and said, well, you've got to take a careful look at it.
That's right, Your Honor. But I think the court also initially thought that it was perfectly okay for Mr. Hammer to represent himself on his own appeal. And I think that goes to the question of discretion of the district
court. That's the legal issue, though. And when it was sent back particularly for factual exploration, usually needs discovery.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. To clarify, I wasn't talking about the first appeal. I was talking about the second appeal. Now, in the summer of 06, we briefed this with Mr. Hammer pro se. And then the court issued an order saying that his counsel would be he would have appointed counsel.
We
rebriefed the entire case.
Right.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the court also initially on this very appeal thought that it was okay for him to be representing himself.
I wouldn't read anything into that. That's just a sorting process that happens before it goes to a panel of three judges. And when a briefing order such as the one that happened here came out, it means the judges of this court have decided that counsel is necessary. So.
Why did the government ignore the due process argument in the response brief?
Well, Your Honor, I apologize for not having a short response to that. What I would say, there are two things I would say about that. The first is that Turner itself has foreclosed that, because Turner involved two claims, one of which was a First Amendment claim about correspondence, and the second was a due process claim about marriage. Turner requires that due process claims be considered under the Turner analysis, the four-factor test. As for the more substantive aspect of the due process claim that was raised here, it's basically a notice and comment requirement that they're alleging. And as Supreme Court and this Court have held, these programs, BOP program statements, in this case the institution supplement, are not subject to notice and comment rulemaking. But again, I apologize for not having spelled out some of this more.
Well, I mean, do you think the argument was forfeited?
I think it's meritless. No, I think it's.
No, you think it's meritless.
Yes, I think in our equal protection section,
right.
We did discuss
yeah.
the fact that Turner does apply here.
You have a minute if you can bear it.
Well, Your Honor, I'd be happy to stand up here and answer any further questions from the court. And
well, you wouldn't be happy.
Yes,
you will,
Your Honor. I love it.
Yeah, eat it up.
This is the top part of my day here, to stand here and answer questions.
Yeah, because now you have to go back.
No, you should go back to O'Hare, probably.
I have to go back to O'Hare, and I hope the weather holds up for me. Thank you.
Safe trip home, anyway.
You know,
I say a safe trip home to you.
Thank you very much,
but
Your
Honor. I'm not done.
Okay. I'm here as long as Your Honor.
Not yet.
Okay.
Are the two groups of prisoners the you know, the death sentence and the other sentences in the SCU, are they separated physically?
They are very much kept separate, yes, Your Honor. There are actually only a handful of the figures I was just given on this. There are 11 of these non-death penalty inmates. There are 46 death penalty inmates. It's a relatively small.
46 now?
That was my reaction too, Your Honor, but that's what I'm told. There are 46 inmates under sentence of death, or as in Mr. Hammer's case, he's got a parallel track going on in the Third Circuit, and that's being briefed now. The government has appealed from the vacation of the death sentence, and that's on appeal right now in the Third Circuit. Yes, the 46, that's what I was told, Your Honor, 46, and I believe there's a 47 at a different facility. That's a woman, and also there may be a medical issue there. I can't give specifics about that. I wouldn't want to misrepresent that.
You said there's a woman and medical
issue? No, there's a woman. I am told there's a female inmate under sentence of death who is not at Terre Haute.
Because it's a male facility. Uh-huh.
I don't know. That, I assume that, Your Honor. I don't know that 100% sure, and I also don't know.
Martha Stewart?
No, it's not. I believe she's escaped.
Okay.
She's busy making money to pay our pay taxes so that the rest of us all can live.
Yeah, I think so, Your Honor. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the court, district court. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bell, how much time does Mr. Bell have? 2 minutes.
Your Honor, unless the court would like me to address the due process question some more or has any other additional questions, we're happy to rest and would just ask that this court reverse the summary judgment order of the district court and remand the case for further proceedings and hopefully with an order to appoint counsel to assist with discovery.
You?
I'd have to ask my supervisor and colleague over there whether or not that would be me.
Once again, thank you so much for the help that you've given us today, court appointed, probably feeling picked on at this point. We are most appreciative of the fine work that you've done. And to you too, Mr. Himmelfarb, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.